This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we offer an outdoors alternative to the traditional Thanksgiving dinner.
It's such a great thing to go and explore, you know, this beautiful country that we have here.
Plus, the Colorado READ Act is getting an external evaluation after progress failed to meet expectations.
And we explore a recent study about how environmental factors impact autism rates.
That's coming up.
It's Tuesday, November 26th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your look at news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. In early October, Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser announced a settlement fund for victims of sexual abuse by Colorado priests, no matter how long ago the abuse occurred. Registration to receive funds from the Colorado Independent Reconciliation and Reparations Program are due on Saturday, November 30th. As of last Friday, the office is working on 21 claims. Jennifer Brown from the Colorado Sun joins us now with more about the fund and the process to apply for it. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Erin. Thanks for having me.
Remind us about the fund. First of all, who is eligible?
So this fund was announced in October, and it was a joint announcement from the State Attorney General's Office and the Diocese in Colorado. And those that are eligible are any person who has been sexually abused by a priest in Colorado going back decades.
And describe the process for applying to the fund.
The process is that you have to make yourself known to the people in charge of the fund, and you have to give your name, some details, you know, the priest that abused you and when this occurred. And after that, there is a review process where they will look into your claim, you know, kind of prioritize these, I guess, maybe is the right word, and see, you know, who deserves what kind of money. And they'll do this by deciding, you know, how credible it is, how egregious it is, et cetera. And it's a confidential process. However, new claims that haven't ever been reported to law enforcement will be reported to law enforcement if a person makes a claim to this fund.
Do we know how much each survivor will receive?
We don't. It's very open-ended, as it was described when it was laid out. They won't put a limit on it. There's not like a certain amount of money. It's the diocese will pay the amount of money that these people in charge of the fund determine is appropriate. The same people running this reconciliation fund in Colorado have run similar funds for priest abuse in New York and California and other states. Kenneth Feinberg, who's in charge of it, has also run the compensation fund for victims of the Aurora theater shooting in Colorado. So they determine how much each person should receive, and the diocese will have to pay each person that amount. And in other states, Mr. Feinberg said that the amount ranged from $10,000 to $500,000.
On the website for the fund, it reads, only if the individual is satisfied with the compensation offered does the individual agree to waive rights to litigate against the diocese. So if someone applies and accepts the money from this settlement fund, then they can't sue the church?
Correct. So each person that makes a claim to this fund will have the opportunity to sit down with a free, independent lawyer to give them advice. People coming forward don't have to pay anything for this process. And it sounds to me, you know, that at that time where the people controlling the fund decide how much money they would receive, they could sit down with this independent attorney and determine whether to sign it and receive the money. And by signing it, they are agreeing not to sue the church based on that claim. And what's interesting to me, Erin, is there have been a lot of attorneys who are advertising now in Colorado since this priest abuse report came out. And I suppose that would be the alternative. You know, you don't go through this fund. You actually file a lawsuit against the church.
Do we know how many people have applied so far?
When the fund was announced in October, there were already 65 people who were just sent packets on how to apply because the state attorney general's office was already aware of their abuse claims. There have been several more since then. There was one woman who called me right before she called the compensation fund. And she was, you know, in her 70s, and as a child, when she was in an orphanage in Pueblo, she had been abused repeatedly by the priest there who lived right next door to the orphanage. And she is someone whose case had never come forward before. She'd never talked about it really in her whole life except for with her husband and her sisters who lived at the orphanage with her. So there will definitely be some cases that come up that had never previously been reported, and her case was not in the independent investigators report that found 43 priests in Colorado who were abusing children.
Jennifer Brown is a writer for the Colorado Sun. You can find links to her reporting on this topic at KUNC.org. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Erin.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
Heavy snow has blanketed much of the northern Front Range, causing widespread travel disruptions ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday. Airlines at Denver International Airport canceled hundreds of flights, and more than 1,000 travelers spent the night camped out there. The Colorado Department of Transportation warns that roads across the northern half of the state are still treacherous. CDOT spokesman Jared File says drivers should stay off the road if possible.
The good news is that a lot of people have been heeding that warning. The roads are staying pretty clear, which is allowing our plow truck drivers better access to be able to clear those roads so they are more drivable tomorrow.
File says a troop-carrying vehicle with tank treads was called out late last night in rural Morgan County to rescue stranded drivers. Road travel should be safer tomorrow and Thursday, with more snow potentially on the way Friday. Drivers should check for the latest road conditions at cotrip.org.
And with frigid temperatures in the forecast overnight, Denver is opening warming centers in the area for those experiencing homelessness. The Denver Post reports nearly 2,000 shelter spaces will be available, with the ability to leverage the city's recreation centers to serve more in an emergency.
Students in the Boulder Valley School District without immunizations or exemption paperwork will not be allowed to return to class after Thanksgiving break. The policy update comes after Littleton School District enforced a similar deadline earlier this month. Spokesman Randy Barber says the district is complying with state laws and being proactive about student health.
We have an understanding of who does have their immunizations and, you know, again, whoever wants to have an exemption, that's fine. That allows us in the course of an emergency to be able to look at a list really quickly and determine what students will be able to come into school and which ones would need to be excluded during an outbreak.
Barber says there are fewer than 100 students in the district who are not immunized or exempt. Those who don't meet the state requirements Monday will be sent home. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Colorado has the lowest measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination rate in the country.
In 2018, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated about 1 in 59 children have autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. That's up from 1 in 68 from the previous estimate 2 years prior. The CDC says the increase could be due, in part, to improved diagnosis in Black and Hispanic children. Their conclusion led a researcher at the University of Colorado Boulder to take a closer look at the data. KUNC's Stephanie Daniel is here to discuss that research with us. Hey, Stephanie.
Hi, Henry.
Cynthia Nevison is this University of Colorado Boulder researcher, normally specializes in climate science, earth and environmental science. Why did she co-author an autism study?
That was my first question. About 12 years ago, when she was expecting her first son, Nevison read an article about autism rates in boys and became concerned.
Today, a pregnant woman has something like a 1 in 25 chance or 4% chance that her son will develop autism. And yet our public health agencies are telling her they don't really know why this is happening, that there's no practical advice they can give her to prevent it. The best she can aim for is early diagnosis.
So for the past 10 years, Nevison has studied government data on ASD rates with the goal of visualizing and quantifying U.S. trends over time.
The public has kind of accepted this narrative of better and expanded diagnosis, but it's actually contradicted by the government's own best available data.
Her study focuses on the prevalence of autism in Black and Hispanic children compared to white children over time, What do we know about what she found?
One of her conclusions confirmed the results of previous studies that shows an increase in ASD rates in children of color. The rates among Hispanics are also rising rapidly, and if the trend continues, they will soon surpass whites. On the other hand, rates for black children have caught up with and passed their white counterparts. Nevison said these findings challenge the theory that there's just a natural genetic level of autism in the population.
Because if blacks are actually surpassing the rates of whites, that suggests that there are environmental factors at play to which blacks are more vulnerable.
Overall, the study reiterates what we already know. Autism rates are increasing. Why report on it?
Nevison mentioned that environmental exposures may contribute to the increase in black and Hispanic children, which intrigued me. But she didn't pinpoint these factors in the study. So I asked a couple organizations in Colorado why they think rates are increasing, including Firefly Autism in Denver.
We're walking through the school age program. We have our primary, elementary, and then this is our early childhood program.
Ken Nguyen is the chief clinical officer. The organization provides a range of services, including on-site early intervention and home and community-based programs. Nguyen takes me to meet 6-year-old Joaquin.
What color? Is it red?
Red.
Joaquin is Mexican and black, and one of a growing number of children of color to be diagnosed with ASD. Today, he's working on colors with Jillian, his early intervention therapist.
What about that one? What color?
Blue.
What color?
Green.
Joaquin is enrolled in Firefly's early childhood program and comes here every day. His mom says he was diagnosed with autism when he was about 4.
You think you just have a bad kid that doesn't listen. That's what I thought it was at first.
Herminia Garcia has an older son and says a red flag went up when Joaquin didn't hit the same milestones.
Once I just started seeing, you know, he wasn't talking, he wasn't, you know, doing stuff that other kids would do. You know, he should have been going potty training, that type of stuff.
A nurse suggested he be tested for autism, which Garcia did through the Jeffco School District. Then they referred Joaquin to Firefly. Here's Ken Nguyen again.
When he first came to us, he kind of was like a bull in a china shop and kind of had a difficulty coordinating with his peers. So we work a lot with group dynamics and social skills within a group.
Nguyen has worked in the field for over 30 years and seen a steady increase in autism, but says in the past it was mainly diagnosed in white kids.
But we've seen over the years that spread into communities of color. I don't believe there's anything specific to those communities that is indicative of that change in prevalence. I think it's about awareness.
Now, I asked him to further clarify why diagnoses have increased in communities of color. He reiterated that there's just more awareness and less stigma around the disorder, and he did not point to environmental factors.
I understand that viewpoint is also shared by the Autism Society of Colorado.
Yes, and they pointed to other studies that found Hispanic and black children receive a diagnosis of ASD later in life and are more likely to be misdiagnosed first compared to their white counterparts. These disparities are caused by several factors, including language barriers, cultural factors, and ASD identification practices that are often standardized with white monolingual children.
I want to come back to Joaquin for a moment. He's been going to Firefly Autism for a couple of years now, and earlier we heard him talking, listing off colors. How's he doing?
His mom, Herminia Garcia, said one of the biggest hurdles was communication. Joaquin didn't talk before, and he's a big, strong kid, so he would often use his body or physical behavior to express himself. But Joaquin's become more verbal, is learning sign language, and even has a talking device.
I started seeing lots of changes in Joaquin. He started listening, he started following direction, he started knowing how to play with his toys, playing with peers.
So after all this reporting, what are the big takeaways?
Both Ken Nguyen at Firefly Autism and the Autism Society of Colorado say early detection is still key and that often starts with parents knowing the signs of autism. Nguyen says the earlier the diagnosis, the earlier a child can receive treatment. And everyone agrees more research needs to be done to better understand the rise in ASD rates, including researcher Cynthia Nevison.
I think that our default assumption should be that these rates are real, they're increasing, they're going to pose an increasing burden on society as, you know, more and more children age out into the adult social services network, and we really need to start addressing this issue with urgency.
And that's why the Colorado Department of Health and Environment has information about autism on its website, including a list of signs and symptoms of ASD and resources for both children and adults who have been diagnosed.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
In 2012, state lawmakers passed the Colorado Read Act, the goal of which is to ensure that each Colorado student is able to read by the time they finish the third grade.
But after years of less than stellar results, the state education department will be spending more than $5 million to determine why reading rates haven't risen according to plan. Ann Shimke has been following the story for Chalkbeat Colorado and joins us now. Hey, Ann.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with the READ Act and how it works. We know the goal is to ensure Colorado students are reading at or above grade level by the time they exit the third grade. How does the law go about trying to achieve that?
So basically, the law requires Colorado schools to test kindergarten through third graders on reading and determine which ones are far behind grade level. Those students are considered to have significant reading deficiencies, and there's a special pot of READ Act money that's earmarked for them. So basically, school districts get a chunk of that money depending on how many struggling readers they have, and they can use the money in a variety of ways. So for example, they can use it on summer school, tutoring, reading coaches, or other kinds of reading interventions.
I know it varies greatly by district depending on what the need is, but do we know about how much money has been allocated for schools to implement these approaches?
This year, for example, it's about $40 million a year for those struggling readers that are way behind grade level. That's around $800, give or take, per student.
So we have some data now that shows an improvement in reading, but it's not a very significant increase. Did lawmakers have different expectations for where we would be at this point?
Yes, absolutely. So it's been over 7 years since the law was signed, and the increases have been really small. So for example, about 38% of third graders were reading proficiently in 2015. Now that number is 41%. So I think there may be differences of opinion about what the ultimate goal was 7 years out. But I think at the very least, the architects of the law hoped for double-digit percentage point increases, at least getting us to more than half of Colorado kids reading proficiently.
That brings us to this external evaluation. This was mandated by state lawmakers last spring, who were facing criticism of the law's cost and, you know, how effective it is.
Lawmakers passed an update to the READ Act during the 2019 legislative session. And one of the things this new law required was an external evaluation of the READ Act. So basically, there's been a groundswell of criticism over the last couple of years about the state's low proficiency rates in reading, the very low progress or slow progress in bumping up those rates. There's also been a lot of questions about what the READ Act money is being spent on and why there's so little information about that. So last week, the state picked a contractor to do this external evaluation. They are WestEd. They're based in San Francisco. They're going to start work in early 2020. And although the evaluation could last 6.5 years, their first big report to the state is due in July of 2021.
Once these results start coming in, or these reports coming in, state officials will be able to get a clearer picture of how school districts were spending READ Act funding. I mean, up until now, what did we know about how schools were spending those dollars?
We had a general idea of how districts planned to use the money. So like I said earlier, whether it was summer school or one-on-one tutoring or reading specialists or other kinds of reading interventions, we had that general kind of broad strokes information. But the state officials that I spoke to said the education department didn't previously have the authority to collect detailed information, like budget level information, from school districts and schools about how they were spending the money. They said this new law that was passed last spring does give that authority, and that's what WestEd, this external evaluator, is going to be able to do, is ask those really specific questions and get that school and district level information.
Is that unusual?
Yes, so it is, and that's exactly a question I asked the state education department, and they said it is unusual, but the reason that it's being done is because there is such a significant amount of money being spent on the READ Act. And It's for a relatively small number of students statewide. So there's about 40,000 students in kindergarten through third grade that are classified as having a significant reading deficiency. And most of the READ Act money is devoted to those 40,000 students.
Ann Shimke is a senior reporter for Chalkbeat Colorado. Ann, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For many, Thanksgiving is a chance to relax and get together with family over a quality meal. For others, the long weekend offers a chance to get out and explore Colorado. I definitely fall into that latter group, or at least I did before the snow began falling Monday evening. So a few weeks ago, I found a local guide with a ton of backpacking experience to take me into the wild and show me what Thanksgiving dinner could look like if we took it out of the kitchen.
This is pretty easy. This is only going to take a few minutes to cook, because you really only have to get a few cups of water boiling.
Eric Carlson is a Colorado native who grew up backpacking with his parents. For our experiment, we hiked out to a clearing near the North Fork of the Buda River.
So, we have stuffing and chicken and mashed potatoes with gravy and some dried herbs. And for dessert, we have sweet potatoes, brown sugar, and marshmallows.
That's the menu Carlson planned out, but we didn't bring a bag of potatoes or a full bird or anything like that.
This is just off-the-shelf box meals, and so it's extremely easy.
Which is good news for those of us who lack culinary skills. It's just items you can pick up at the supermarket on your way out of town. The chicken is pre-cooked and in a pouch. The gravy, stuffing, and potatoes are all dried.
The hardest thing, I think, is making sure that you have the correct cooking utensils and maybe a stove, things like that. That's going to be the hardest thing for someone who wants to make a meal like this that's not in their comfort of their own kitchen.
As an avid outdoorsman, he often dehydrates his own food to bring backpacking, but the food he typically prepares is different than what's laid out in front of us.
This powder will become gravy. It's maybe a little concerning.
And that's coming from a guy who dehydrates a lot of his own food.
That's right, yeah. But my dehydrated food does not have inosinate, guanylate.
Nevertheless, Carlson presses on with the meal ahead. He uses a spork, you know, the spoon-fork hybrid you get at fast food joints, to mix the various packets of food into the boiling water. Beyond the food, the best part of all of this is just being out in nature. That's the point of this trip, after all, making the most of the long weekend coming up. If you're on the fence about trying something like this during the holiday, here's Carlson's argument.
When you're given the opportunity to have, you know, a Thursday off of work and can probably take a Friday off, so you have a four-day weekend, I feel like it's such a great thing to go and explore, you know, this beautiful country that we have here. And if planning a meal is difficult for you, or figuring out what to eat or what to bring along, you know, don't let that get in the way of your adventures.
At the end of it all, I think we were both pleasantly surprised at how well it turned out. Then again, Carlson made a few additions to punch up the otherwise standard fare, like adding cheese and dried herbs to the mashed potatoes. All in all, the feast was a success.
As far as like a backpacking meal, this is a 10 out of 10 for a backpacking meal. It's super packable, super easy to make. It took us 10 minutes to make this. It's very easy to make, and it tasted great. So I would give this a 10 out of 10 as far as a backpacking meal goes.
And I would have to agree with that score. Big thanks to local backpacking expert Eric Carlson. He's actually going to be putting his culinary skills for Thanksgiving to the test during a backpacking trip through Utah this weekend. So wish him luck. And if you want to see photos of the meal he made, the equipment he used, or the vista we had as we were cooking, head over to KUNC.org. You can see those photos. And while you're there, get some tips for high-altitude baking.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, we dive into the history of Arlo Guthrie's 18-minute protest song, Alice's Restaurant, and learn about why it's now a Thanksgiving staple. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.